love at all. I mean there will never be no love at all.
Got to build
so
our
build
love
our love
on one foundation. Got
come
to
let
build
us build our
love
on one
foundation.
Solid foundation.
Got to build our love
or there will never be a single drop of blood. You won't have no freedom, yeah. Got to come together. We are birds of a feather. We got to come together, cause we are birds of a feather. Or there will never be, Lord of mercy, no love at all. There will never be, yeah, yeah, no love at all. We also got to realize we are one people, yeah. Got to realize that we are one.
Morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Well, no, not a September 11th show in that sense, but it is the second Saturday, the first Saturday after Labor Day in September, which means our guest is Barry N. Malzberg. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. That was shorter than I expected, that movement. That was an excerpt, but a short excerpt from Shostakovich. And let's see. So this was that wasn't from one of the jazz suites, was it?
That is Waltz 2 from the second jazz suite.
Oh, it is. Okay. Yeah. Do me a favor. I haven't set Barry up properly yet because we've been. I was talking to Hobte and Ian Forrest and all that, and you know, not paying attention the way I should, having too much of a good time. And usually, often I take a longer musical break than I did, but that's all right. That's just fine. It's a crowded weekend in so many ways for me. Let me start with announcements. Ah, yes. I have one of them in my pocket, so let me get these out of the way at the beginning of the show. Let's see. The KGB Fantastic Fiction Series is this Wednesday, and I know Scott Westerfeld is one of the two readers, and I have forgotten. It's a terrible thing to say. I don't know the other reader, so I will look it up and let you all know. But that's this Wednesday at 7 o'clock at the KGB Bar at 85 East 4th Street, and highly recommended whoever will be there. And Scott Westerfeld is always wonderful. Now, this weekend is the Brooklyn Book Festival, and that's actually today. Saturday and Sunday, but the what's of particular interest to me is a panel at 2 o'clock called "The Unheard of Magnitude of Fiction." Interesting title. And Bill Evans, whose work I do not know, co-author of Category 7, N.K. Jemisin. That's Nora Jemisin for our regular listeners, who's been on this show a number of times, and in fact will be on this show next Saturday as one of a group of people, and Karen Lord from Barbados, and I will be interviewing her in a recorded interview on Monday. I have a number of things backing up, but Karen just got into town, and first novel has gotten excellent reviews in the among other places in the New York Times. Actually, I think it was Jeff Vandermeer, of all people, reviewed her book Redemption in Indigo in the New York Times, and it's published by Small Beer Press. And so that will be at the Brooklyn Historical Society today. Actually, Brooklyn Borough Hall, 209 Geralamin Street. At no, what am I saying? It's tomorrow. I'm sorry. It's the 12th. It's not today. The festival begins
festival
today.
The festival is all weekend, yes.
Yeah, the festival is all weekend. This particular event is tomorrow. Also, on September 14th, which is Tuesday, Karen Lord will be reading with Julia Holmes, whose novel Meeks has also been reviewed lately with great reviews and is also a Small Beer Press book. And that will be at the Greenlight Bookstore again in Brooklyn, big week in Brooklyn, at 686 Fulton Street. So for more information, really the best place to go is to the website for the Brooklyn Book Festival. And that should tell you more. Now, next week on this program will be our once postponed event with Altered Fluid. Altered Fluid is a writer's group consisting of a lot of fine writers. There's about 10 people in the group. And what happens is they come in and somebody reads the first draft of a short story, which has been, in fact, it was distributed yesterday by email to all the people in the group. They get to read it. The author, who in this case will be Kay Tempest Bradford. Tempest is a fine writer. She's been on this show solo. Tempest will read the story aloud on the air. Everybody will have read it, but she won't be altering it. This is the first draft. And then everybody in the group will critique the story. Each person will have 2 minutes or 3 minutes, depending on how long the reading is. Judging from what I saw of the story, it's going to be more like 2 to 2.5 minutes. And in that group are Matt Kressel, Aliyah Dawn Johnson, it's 10 people. I'm sorry, I don't have all the names in front of me. Tune in next week, and you will have them all. The aforementioned Nora Jemison, Chris Dykeman, Eugene Myers. It's a fine group of mostly young writers. When I say young, the oldest are like 30-somethings. You know, Paul Berger, David Mercurio Rivera. This is about our 6th or 7th time doing this, having the writers group come on and one person reads and everybody critiques. And at some point, I'm thinking of doing a follow-up because of the stories that have been read on the air in first draft. The 5 or 6, about 3 or 4 have been published after a 3rd or 4th draft. And I think it would be very interesting from a technical, writing technical point of view to compare the published story with the critique of the original, to see how they were altered.
Depending upon how fixated your audience is on this.
Yeah.
Are there, and to what degree, how many people out there are interested in the difference between a first and a second and a fourth draft?
Well, we were...
And what I'm really asking is what percentage of listeners now are writers or would-be writers or ex-writers. There was
or wannabes.
See, all wannabes. There
yeah,
was
or
some,
you said would-be, yeah.
There was some panel at Worldcon. I don't remember when or the subject. I don't remember anything except that Harlan Ellison asked how many people in this room want to be writers, and 95% of the room raised their hands.
Yeah.
That's your audience. That may be the case here, although I don't... Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think that any radio host, even the most arrogant, really knows to whom he or she is talking.
No.
Really knows the nature of that audience.
You get emails, you get phone calls and all that, but all that represents are the people who are willing to email and the people who call in.
And how representative of the audience are the callers?
That's right. Now, I can tell you that of the callers, many, many of them are interested in the professionalism of writing, the mechanics of writing, of the frequently asked questions that people call up with are, what are your disciplines when you write? Do you write every day? They really are, of the callers, there is a very high percentage of would-be writers.
Yes.
Of the listeners, what percentage of the listeners are the callers? There's no way of knowing. So it's a percent of a percent. What I sometimes have to go by is I'm fascinated by it. And I can tell you that about 15 years ago, I had Carol Emshwiller on the show 3 times in the space of about 6 months. And each time we dealt with a single short story. And mm-hmm. one was the germination of it, where she had notes. The second was like a second draft. And then the third time was when she was teaching it to a class after mm-hmm. it had been published. Now that was actually like 1.5 years after the first two, mm-hmm. come to think of it. And I personally was fascinated watching the mechanics of a short story being built. and being put together. And I think that while some people, you know, as writers, you know, they may or may not want to be writers, I think, you know, people who have no interest in making movies are fascinated by that process. And for God knows what reason, people are fascinated by the back lights at the background of WBAI and what goes on behind the scenes. Yeah. And I am hoping, I believe, but as you say, there is no knowing. But I just believe that there is a percentage of the audience who enjoys learning about the mechanics of writing. Having said that, your point is well taken.
Yeah, but having said that, you can, of course, shape your audience. The audience is shaped in terms of the programmer, in terms of the host. I forget who, what BAI person said that. I think it was
Josephson. I would
guess. Josephson said it, but this is the guy. He was on Sundays at 11 a.m. for many years.
Mike Fader.
Mike Fader, yes, and the whole anti-Semitism. Yeah. Fader said that one of the truisms of radio, as he understood it, is that the host gathers to himself people like him. That you're talking eventually to refractions of yourself out there, because those who aren't like you disappear. They're not interested. So you get that phenomenon in which the host has the illusion that this is the audience.
Yeah. And I think it's a point well taken.
In its most manifest or dangerous form, you have Glenn Beck or Rush Limbaugh, who believe that their audience is wholly representative of the world.
And I learned that fallacy when I was young and started doing shows here, first under Baird Searles. That was mostly a reviews show.
Yeah.
But later when I started co-hosting Hour of the Wolf with Margot Adler, and then when I took the mantle of the show itself, I was young. I had the belief that I was doing the show for the science fiction fanish community. And so I would come back from a Worldcon or something like that, and I would talk about, oh, John Singer and I went into a place in Toronto and had dumplings. Mm-hmm. It's just the kind of thing that you would read in a zine, just the kind of thing that, or today in a blog. It's there is really no difference. And I thought, wow, what a job I am doing. I've taken that fanish community that's in the fanzine and brought it to tens of thousands of people at worst. And then at some point, I thought about it. I thought about the fact that the most attended Worldcon ever was probably about 7,000 people.
That's exactly right. That would be Los Angeles in 86, I believe.
Okay. And assume that double that number of people would have considered going. Were they able to get there, able to afford it, whatever. This means that if I had every science fiction fan listening at once, it would still be but a fraction of the audience when we get to 6 a.m., when we reach prime time.
Right.
And frankly, the cab drivers who were tuning in, the artists and sculptors or whatever, I always mention sculptors because the very first show Margot ever did, she said, who's listening? And we got a sculptor calling up, so yeah. I always remember that. Two sculptors, in fact, mm-hmm. The same morning. I thought that was amazing. So it's not talking to them. And if I, in fact, accomplished what I had wanted, if I had done a radio show that had reached all the science fiction fans that there were to listen, it would be a very poor showing in terms of listenership.
Exactly. Exactly. And that really is why, and as you know, when we've discussed this and I've written about it, is why modern science fiction in the last 20 years has become, is in serious trouble, because its writers, its perpetrators are increasingly addressing an insular community, sophisticated community, which can penetrate the protocols of what have become very sophisticated protocols of science fiction, which shut out the more general audience.
Hmm.
And this is a point I have made, to be specific, and I've made this here, I've made it in many places. When I was 13 years old, not even, when I was 12 years old, I bought the March 52 issue of Galaxy Science Fiction from Simon's Candy Store in Brooklyn, which contained The Year of the Jackpot by Robert Heinlein and the last installment of The Demolished Man by Alfred Bester, which really, I think we can agree, 57, 58 years later, that's as good as it gets still.
Yeah.
And I fell into
both of
that.
Those, yeah.
Both of those. I fell into that. And at once, I had some reading knowledge of science fiction. I had read a few magazines before, but this was my first purposeful purchase of a science fiction magazine, and I was at home. Try that with Charles Stross and Paul Macaulay today.
Mm-hmm.
Can the equivalent 13-year-old find a Stross novel, a Macaulay novel, a Stephen Baxter novel, mm-hmm. and know what the heck is going on?
Possibly a Stephen Baxter.
Perhaps.
And it depends
on
which
trouble.
One.
I'm having trouble with Stephen Baxter. I think that I just do not think.
I agree on the
that a casual reader can really understand this. You take Dozois Year's Best SF, and I have the 27th annual volume, which just came out. I got that. I've got that last month. That is, in my opinion, utterly forbidding to all but the most sophisticated readers.
Interesting. But you know what I think some of that has been replaced by? Some of it has been replaced by not necessarily the writing, but the marketing. Case in point, Scott Westerfeld, who will be reading at KGB this week, wrote some really fine, admittedly adult, very adult, science fiction novels and short stories, some of them utterly wonderful. And then he discovered the market. The market is YA, young adult.
Mm-hmm.
And he has become huge, huge seller in that field. And I think there are people that are turning in what once upon a time may have been a science fiction story, novel, to an agent or publisher. And I'm trying to remember who it was, but I had one person on the show who said that when they turned in a story about somebody who resembled the author, who was in their late 20s, said, can you make mm-hmm. the protagonist more like 19?
Mm-hmm.
If you can do that, and you know, not dumb it down, but just make it so that it resembles a YA book just by changing the age of the protagonist, then they had a huge sale, a really good sale. And the book was hopefully otherwise uncompromised. So I think that a lot of what would have been, you know, this certainly doesn't apply to The Demolished Man, but it does apply to an extent, for example.
It certainly applies to Citizen of the Galaxy.
Yeah.
Double Star.
Yeah.
The Door into Summer.
Which in those days we called juveniles, the Heinlein juveniles. And now would be.
Although all of those novels, as you know, were serialized in the, in quotes, adult science fiction magazines.
That's right.
Double Star and Citizen of the Galaxy appeared in Astounding in 56 and 57. Dorian De Summer and FNSF in 58.
Mm-hmm.
They were published in as adult work in serial form, and then were published as YA, but YA was one of Vonnegut's FOMA. Everybody knew that YA was a marketing term. These were yeah. novels.
Yeah, exactly. And who was it? Simon and Schuster who put out the Heinlein?
Scribner.
It was Scribner. It was somebody with an S. I knew that. The term juveniles, you don't even hear that much anymore.
No.
They don't even call the first Harry Potter books, which are probably aimed at, you know, 9-year-olds and 10-year-olds can easily read the first 2 or 3 of the Harry Potter books before they start getting more adult and darker and more sophisticated. And even those are referred to as YA.
Yes.
As a marketing term.
That is correct.
So, and I think that a lot of what would otherwise be the accessible science fiction has been basically drawn like a magnet. The writers are drawn to this YA market.
I think that's true. That has left, however, the adult, the cutting edge, and I've got quote marks all over here, but it's marginalized it.
Yeah,
severely.
I think you're right. I mean, there is also the other field of the more literary speculative fiction, the things that are published by, for example, Small Beer Press, like Gavin Grant and Kelly Link put out,
mm-hmm.
And they are not. Yeah, Lester Del Rey would never have accepted any of this stuff as science fiction. But it is, I think, within the same genre, which I, of course, draw a very wide lasso. Who, by the way, do you attribute the term to? I always loved the term. I've heard it referred to as Damon Knight, but there's controversy. Science fiction is what I'm pointing at.
That is Knight.
That is Damon Knight. Okay.
Science fiction is what I'm pointing at when I say this is science fiction.
Right. And that is my definition.
Which is really as reasonable as any. Science fiction feels like science fiction. It's the kind of tautology into which the fan community falls easily enough. But I know science fiction. I know the difference between Richard Powers and Damon Knight, say. And what Powers is writing is highly speculative and technological, but it is not science fiction in the traditional term. Of course it blurs. You get to a point. You can argue Thomas Pynchon for hours whether Gravity's Rainbow is a science fiction novel. I think it isn't. Hmm. I think that 1984 is not a science fiction novel.
Interesting.
I think they fall into the tradition of Western fabulation, if you were. The fabulation in Western literature, just as Victorian romance can be codified as a particular thing. Science fiction, as Damon said, is what I point to when I say science fiction, and you begin by saying science fiction is a kind of work which has been published with the label science fiction in a science fiction market, packaged in a science mm-hmm. fiction way. That becomes tautological in the extreme and can be infuriating to people who don't understand that it is not exclusionary so much as it is a way of identifying a distinct genre. A genre to which Pynchon and Powers and Vonnegut do not belong, but Dish and Ballard and I do. And that argument just goes on and on. Almost irresolute. When I say Vonnegut does not belong, Vonnegut published 2 stories in Galaxy and a few Harrison Bergeron in FNSF and began as a more or less conventional science fiction writer and got out about as soon as he became aware of what that could do to him, which was not very good.
And it was a marketing decision.
And it was a marketing decision. Pynchon was never in. Never.
I see your point. And in terms of literature, I think you're, of course, right. But I also think that, again, when we draw that wide lasso, especially for the purposes of this radio show, I would argue that, you know, Cat's Cradle, which ends in, you know, the world being covered in ice 9, Gravity's Rainbow, which starts with a cataclysm in space that affects Earth, and so forth, use science fiction within their literature. And they certainly belong to that great larger genre, which, for lack of anything else, we sometimes use the term speculative fiction, which is a Heinlein coined phrase, I believe.
Yeah.
And the but Heinlein didn't mean it in the sense that it's really used today. Today it's used as that ever so wide. You can't throw Tolkien into speculative fiction. But there is nevertheless a literature of the imagination to which Vonnegut and Borges and Pynchon and you and Heinlein and Alfie Bester all belong.
Well,
and Tolkien.
As Russell Galen, the Scott Meredith agent, said, yes and no. Yes and no is mm-hmm. the answer to that. I will tell you.
Yeah, I'm not. Yeah, yes and no is, I'm sure, the right answer.
Yes and no is the only answer. But I'll tell you what I think here. I'll take no more than 2 minutes to expand. The last phone call I ever made, the last time I was a radio caller, was 30 years ago to you in September of 79, when something came up on this program. You talked about how science fiction was expanding in all ways, and so much of what we read and saw and was science fiction, which would devour the world. And I called to say that I felt, Jim, that you and your guest, and I forget who the guest was, were falling into a trap which I called at that time Judith Merrillism. Judith Merrillism was the campaign of the late Judith Merrill, novelist, short story writer, anthologist, and figure of great fun, 1923 to 1997, to, in her famous year's best anthologies in her criticism, to shovel everything under the tent of science fiction.
That's right.
That you made, that everybody, Russell Baker columns.
If it was imaginative, she put
it. If it was imaginative, it was science fiction. And Russell Baker's column, there was a Russell Baker column which she anthologized in one of the year's best, John Ciotti,
She went
Art Buchwald, everything.
She also went out of her way to find people from other countries.
Precisely, right.
And so,
and she was in a campaign to expand science fiction, to make everything science fiction.
Yeah.
To which my reply was from Gilbert and Sullivan's The Gondoliers, W.S. Gilbert, if everyone is somebody, then nobody's anybody. If everything is science fiction, nothing is science fiction. And what she and a guy like Arthur Jean Cox, who wrote briefly a movie column, a media column in FNSF in the mid-50s, and Arthur Jean Cox reviewed Little Abner, the musical, as science fiction. And I there are limits, and I think that Cox,
there was a time when
Cox
I might
found
have
them.
Done that myself.
Cox found them, Merrill 12. Found them, and it what you did not have, if you did this, then you obliterated science fiction. Then you did not have what the late James Blish called the true quill. And the true quill was something that even to this moment we can all identify. As I said, it is clear to me, I have no ambiguity or ambivalence. Dish and Ballard and I were science fiction writers. Silverberg, in his literary period, We came out of science fiction. We were writing science fiction. We understood that. We Camp Concentration and Crash and the Atrocity Exhibition reference science fiction. They can only be understood in terms of their place within the genre. Gravity's Rainbow, no. Slaughterhouse-Five, no. And if you misperceive that,
How about Cat's Cradle?
Similarly, I would say that there were two stories in Galaxy in '53, which are wholly respectable category science fiction, which proved to me that, and Harrison Bergeron in FNSF in '52, they're science fiction. Vonnegut could do it. He understood it. He was like Dish and Ballard and myself. He read this stuff, and Brian Aldiss. He read it. It made the necessary impression, a pubescent impression, and then he went out of it. Whereas people like Pynchon and Powers, if they read it, they read it late. They read it after they were established writers themselves. It was not implanted within them. And there is this about science fiction, and Damon was exactly right. If, when you point to it, you know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really see how anyone familiar with science fiction could not make that discrimination. Someone like Don Walheim, or John Clute, who was our most brilliant critic and one of the most brilliant minds alive. Clute understands immediately and intuitively, in every cell, the difference between Pynchon and Ballard. And it is an important difference.
Mm-hmm.
And it
there is an important difference. I absolutely agree. And yet, I would not hesitate to recommend Pynchon as an example of somebody who is using the tropes of science fiction very well to further his literature.
Yes, of course. Absolutely. And there are a lot of them. There's Margaret Atwood. There's Borges. There are a lot of people that we could cite. They use these tropes. They understand them. They can be quite skillful.
And so when I throw my lasso, as I term it, I will, if you like Judy Merrill them, I will include them, partly because, of course, I'm doing a radio show that, as I said earlier, I realized at some point needs to reach out to everybody. And I also try within that to, instead of broadcasting to the Fanish community, I try to be sort of an ambassador from the Fanish community. And as such, I need to, I won't say inflate the importance of science fiction, but I want to do what I think probably Judith Merrill wanted to do as well, which is to make people recognize and realize how important that is to literature in general, and those same science fiction tropes. So I will embrace Borges and Pynchon and Kelly Link and all of these writers, even though it is very arguable that what they are writing is not science fiction. And yet, and it's not necessarily genre, what they are writing. But it uses the tropes. And the person who reads A, I think, will also appreciate B. I think the person who reads Bester will also appreciate Vonnegut.
I think so. But will that person appreciate Kelly Link? Now, this is another...
Well, I think somebody who appreciates Vonnegut will appreciate Kelly Link, but not necessarily
not in
Bester.
The same way. There are people who read Dostoevsky and pornography and enjoy them both. The issue is whether Kelly Link's work can be seen as connected to science fiction. And this too is an issue that I've approached in a few essays. I've seen Kelly Link has two Nebula Awards, Ellen Clodges Basement Magic has a Nebula Award. There has been work not only published but celebrated in science fiction in the last 10 years, which to me bears no resemblance to science fiction. There was a fair amount of controversy on Karen Joy Fowler's, as you know, What I Didn't See, which is a mainstream literary short story published by Ellen Datlow online in 2003, which won a Nebula for best short story, and as some very angry people pointed out in print, is not science fiction. It references a famous science fiction story by James Tiptree, but it is not itself. The Fowler story is not.
I would have to agree with that.
Is not remotely science fiction, and some people were infuriated by this. The pure blood of science fiction was being polluted, if not corrupted and destroyed, by the Kelly Link and the Karen Joy Fowler and the Ellen Clodges. However meritorious their work, were not writing science fiction, and to say that it was to destroy the category. But then again, Jim, what you have with the Fowler Nebula, what you have in What I Didn't See, is the inevitable outcome of what I call Judith Merrillism. If Merrill won her point, which she apparently has, then this is what has happened. Then a literary short story has won a Nebula for Best Science Fiction Short Story of the Year.
Mm-hmm. How bad a thing is that?
That's a question I can't answer. That's a rhetorical question.
It is.
That's something you could almost throw to the audience. How bad a thing is it? I mean, in Ellen Datlow's mind, and in Karen Fowler's, and on Tuesdays and Thursdays, in my mind, it's a good thing. It's a fine story. It is a story deeply linked to SF tradition, because it can only be fully understood if you've read and Tiptree's what. The women that men don't see. That the Fowler story only blooms to its fullest extent if you've read the Tiptree. But then it's a rhetorical question. It is a profound question. It goes to the center of what is happening has happened to science fiction.
I would say has happened.
And
I think what has happened is that the literature has changed, that the definition is still a good one, and yet the literature, it has spawned other literatures. It has both matured and in some ways left the nest, completely left the nest, which is what I think something that you cannot define easily, like Kelly Link's speculative fiction stories, like The Girl Detective and things like that, which are works of the imagination, by no means science fiction. And, you know, certainly not high fantasy in the Tolkien tradition. They're not magical realism. No. In the Borgesian tradition. What are they? I don't know what they are. But I do believe that they are, I do believe that without science fiction, without what came before, those stories, those writings would not exist. I think that it is an evolutionary step in a literature.
That is certainly true of the Fowler story. It is absolutely, as I've said, Fowler's references
Kelly,
Tiptree. I don't think it's necessarily true of Link. And if you want to be cynical, if you want to be nothing but cynical, you could say that a writer like Kelly Link is making a career in science fiction because it is easy. She has been able to put into science fiction quality lit stories for which there is much less of a market. She has used science fiction to publish non-science fiction stories which have only the most glancing resemblance. But because she has lots of friends and contacts in science fiction and certainly smart enough, she has been able to do this with a good deal of sophistication.
Yeah, I would say I was proud of myself for one pairing. Now I'm thoroughly embarrassed. A really great, top-notch mainstream, I'm wiggling my fingers as everybody in the radio can hear, writer. And I paired her with, at a reading, Tom Dish. Mm-hmm. It was under a month before he killed himself. It was June 6th. He killed himself on July 4th of that year, whichever year it was. And
Oh, wait.
Okay.
2 years and 2 months, three months ago.
Okay. And what she wrote was a story in which presidents of the United States and other figures, some of which are of literature, were horses. Mm-hmm. And talking as horses and other animals and creatures, completely literature of the imagination, just far-flung imagination. And I believe it was published in The New Yorker, no less. And she has a collection of short stories, not one story of which couldn't be considered fantastic in its way.
Now that Jim, we've always had. That's I'm thinking of Talking Horse by Bernard Malamud, which was second prize in the O. Henry Awards in 1969.
Great example.
That was published in The Atlantic. The Atlantic Monthly, with no reference whatsoever to science fiction. And I remember the line from the story, am I a man inside a horse, talking in the form of a horse, or am I a horse who has learned to talk?
I had forgotten that. Yeah.
And it's a wonderful, ever so Jewish conundrum.
Yeah. I would, by the way, Happy New Year, everybody listening. I would, by the way, argue that a lot of Malamud.
Oh, yeah. The Jew Bird, most notably, yes.
Yeah, published by Jack Dann, or republished by Jack Dann in Wandering Stars, an anthology of Jewish science fiction. Wonderful.
I'm running. Story. I'm flying, but I'm also running. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And yet, it is also a literary work.
Sure.
It really, that's a story that straddles the fence. Although it doesn't straddle the definition, it is clearly genre.
Although clearly its influences are more those of Isaac Bashevis Singer or Sholem Aleichem,
right,
than they are of Ray Bradbury, say.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let alone A.E. Van Vogt. It is The Jew Bird could, and in fact was, published in FNSF. It was reprinted there. But that was a kind of consequence of it being Bernard Malamud. It was a kind of Judith Merrillism to put that story in it. See,
and in that
they do it too.
Right, right. But I would also argue in that same Judith Merrillism tradition, which you rightly point out I adhere to or use, that The Natural, a baseball novel by Malamud, is genre. Not the movie at all. Not the movie. The movie, you can argue, oh, there's a little bit of magic. But that's just fate. That's just destiny. But the novel, there is no question. The novel
is fabulation. Yes.
Yes. Great word. Fabulation. It certainly is. And it's using the Siegfried myth. It's using Greek heroic tragedies. Mm-hmm. It's using all of these things. And there is no question that the powers involved, the incidents involved in The Natural are, in fact, super. natural. There is a power at work. There is something at work that is non-human, and that's very much a part of that book. So in my Judith Merrillism, Lasso, or whatever, I say that's, I won't say it's genre. I won't say it's within the genre, but it belongs to this wide field that, again, the reader of Bradbury will also appreciate,
right,
the writing of Malamud.
Right. Shirley Jackson is another example of a yeah, writer who could really do this, but stayed outside of it, and very
Haunting
successfully.
Of Hill House.
Yes. Yes, and wonderful stories like One Ordinary Day with Peanuts,
oh,
to say nothing of The Lottery.
Of course. And The Lottery, you know...
The Lottery, I have been saying. The Lottery, she wrote an essay which has been reprinted about, and people went crazy. The New Yorker readership went crazy with The Lottery. Letters ranging from, you ought to be killed for writing this, to, where is this town? I want to go there. It was the most controversial notice story the New Yorker had published up to that time in 1948, and the New Yorker then was 23 years old. I have pointed out, if that story had appeared in Weird Tales, shrug, turn to the next.
Absolutely.
It would have fit in, or Planet Stories for that matter.
Yeah.
The science fiction reader in 1948 would have found it a neat, cute, unremarkable piece of fabulation and passed on. That she got a what
better,
she got better. was pretty much a category SF story of that time into the New Yorker, and they went mad because of the protocol of the New Yorker story could not be expanded to embrace that. It was among many other things a parable of the Holocaust, but it was something which New Yorker readers couldn't understand it, and the 14-year-olds who read Weird Tales would have shrugged, said good story, and turned the page.
Yeah, we have to point out to people that when he said they would have shrugged, not in not liking it, but in saying this is what we read.
This is what we read, and that's good. That's another good one.
But you see, and there I would argue that is the kind of literature that is the forebear of Kelly Link. That kind of story.
Yes. I think that's fair. I think it's fair to say that.
Yeah. So if Shirley Jackson is and is not, you know, The Lottery, if that is something that would belong in Weird Tales, perfectly well. And what Jeff and Ann Vandermeer are making of Weird Tales again today,
mm-hmm.
I think they're trying to return to that sensibility.
Right.
If that's what they were writing then, and if we can say either then or with hindsight, yes, that's genre. Yes, that belongs in the literature that we embrace. Then I would say that we have to embrace Kelly Link's writing in that same way. Now, is it science fiction?
Well, in this case, that's a war which is settled. It has been accepted. She's won two Nebulas.
Yeah.
There's no anti-Kelly Link constituency.
But it's not just the people that she knows. I think it is, it is her literature. It is what she is writing, for the most part. And
yes.
And I, knowing Kelly and having had her on this show, I know what she's read. I know where she is coming from. She is coming from the, she isn't just reading mainstream literature or something. She is coming out of the genre. Her forebears are within the genre. So is she not?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think you're right. In that, yes, she does come out of that tradition. And that's the point, as I said 15 minutes ago. Mm-hmm. Pynchon doesn't.
Right.
He doesn't. Pynchon is not referencing science fiction. Kelly Link has obviously read it. She's read a lot of it.
Yeah.
Karen Joy Fowler is had read even more than that. She comes centrally out of it. Her first collection, Artificial Things, is full of science fiction stories. Whether you like them or not, they're science fiction. They don't make sense unless they are perceived through that lens.
Yeah.
If you hate Kelly Link, which I don't, but if you did hate it, you could say that we brought this on ourselves. That this is an inevitable outcome of what I call Judith Merrillism.
Mm-hmm.
That if you track Judith Merrillism from her first year's best, 1955, right through the half century, this is going to happen. If you're putting Russell Baker and John Chiari in year's best SF, then you are going to have Kelly Link winning a Nebula.
So within the genre, we have a literary diaspora.
Clearly. Clearly. The genre used to be perceived in the 50s as something you wanted to leave. James Blish, of all people, has a line in one of his essays collected in Issue at Hand about a certain writer who happened. He didn't know it at the time. The writer was Jean Michel, a famous fan writing under a pseudonym. But he said about this story and this writer is obviously so good and so talented and so self-aware, I don't know what he's doing writing science fiction. Now, of all people, you would not nominate James Blish. He wouldn't be among your first 20 guesses who would write that line in a fanzine review. But he felt that way. That is not a line which would be written today.
No.
But
not
the advice to good writers in the 50s, really, to those who took note of their work at all, was, why are you doing this? Get out. Michael Sharer reports in his senior year in college, he wrote a science fiction short story for a creative writing course.
Mm-hmm.
And the teacher said, you have talent. Why are you writing this? Write literature.
Yeah.
Frank Robinson, who sold his first story to Astounding at about that time, The Maze, said he had exactly the same reaction in a college class. You're really good. Why are you wasting your time doing this?
And as I love to tell, and with Bradbury's 90th birthday recently, I've told frequently, I was flunked for a book report in the sixth grade for reviewing or writing up The Martian Chronicles, mm-hmm. not literature.
Yeah. So that was that better? No, it wasn't better. I don't. If James Blish, one of our two great founding critics, publishes a line saying this writer is too talented and interesting to stay in science fiction, this does not portend well for the state of the field in 1954.
Yeah.
We've come a long way.
We really have. And I think that there is still a literature. We still use that term. But it is in some ways as meaningful as it is when somebody says that they dial a phone, they dial a number when they speak into their iPhone and say, call this person or that person. They've never seen a dial in their life.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they are dialing a phone. So I would argue that a lot of what is science fiction bears that relation. It's not the same. It's just not the same. And yet it is the consequence. It has come out from that.
Yes. Yes. And again, back to Damon Knight. And you know it has. You know that Kelly Link has come out of it and that Pynchon hasn't. You know you can point to Kelly Link and say, if not this is science fiction, this is out of science fiction. This is an extension of science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Gravity's Rainbow could have been written if Hugo Gernsback had never drawn breath or founded Amazing Stories. Gravity's Rainbow would still exist.
Yeah.
But What I Didn't See by Karen Fowler could not. And that's important.
That's an interesting distinction, yeah. But I said this earlier, and, just again, Gravity's Rainbow may not be science fiction, but it uses it.
Sure.
absolutely uses it. And therefore, when I draw that lasso, I would never say that Thomas Pynchon is a science fiction writer. But if somebody says, what should I read that involves science fiction? I would say, well, don't discount Pynchon. That's, you know, Crying of Lot 49 and all that. That's all good for the people who read the same genre.
Yeah, yeah.
And how we define that, I don't know. This has been a fascinating discussion, and it's one without an easy resolution because it is a diaspora. It is something that has emerged and evolved and still is this thing. There is still a need for the marketing title, for the SFWA, Science Fiction Writers of America, which I think very little of what is published from the writers of Science Fiction Writers of America is science fiction. But it is still...
But you can only understand it in terms of science fiction, of its emergence.
Yeah, exactly, yes. Exactly. And I leave it to John Clute and Graham Slight, who...
Slight is also very good.
Yeah, yes. He's going to be here in a week and a half, and he was going to be my live guest in 2 weeks, but I will not be here, so I'm trying to figure out how to work that out with him so that so that we can make that happen. His case, I may do a phone show. Mm-hmm. It's very, very rare that I will do a phone interview. I did my third in 20 years. This week with Sherry Tepper, who has a new novel out, The Water's Rising, and it actually went rather well. But I made her read her reading she did on a cassette. Mm-hmm. I won't take a reading over the phone.
That's reason, yes.
Yeah, but Graham doesn't have to do a reading. He's a critic. But anyway, so as I was saying, I will leave to Graham Slight and John Clute, and trying to think, do we have women critics out there?
Elizabeth Hand.
Yeah, Liz Hand.
Who is quite good.
Yeah.
Quite good.
Yeah. And I was going to say something about you can count all the great critics on one hand, and maybe Liz is the one.
There certainly have been less great critics of science fiction than great writers of SF.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you think?
Yeah, absolutely.
You might name 7 or 8 great critics of people who could both write and really understood the genre.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you have a lot of writers like myself who will do occasional criticism.
Yeah. You and Norman Spinrad.
Everybody does a column.
Le Guin. Now, Le Guin has written, but she's not really a critic. She's an essayist.
No, that's right.
She's an essayist. Some of those essays are seminal. Some of those essays are fabulous.
She's quite good. And I would say Alex Panshin. Everything he says is wrong, but
but he's great to read. And and it's a great point of departure.
Yes. Yeah. I forget somebody said this 20 years ago. What a great quote. Charles Platt printed it in his fanzine. United States science fiction editors know more than British science fiction editors, but everything they know is wrong.
Wow, great line.
I think that in many ways that Alex Panshin has a fierce grasp of science fiction. He's just wrong.
I don't care. I love reading him. Love reading Heinlein in Dimension. I've not read the new. There's apparently some new Heinlein criticism book out there, which I've not read.
There's a new Heinlein biography, of course.
Oh, that's probably what I'm thinking.
There's
of.
Some guy named Thompson, I think.
That's
Volume 1 of a 2-volume biography of Heinlein.
Yeah.
And I'll read it. I'm not. It's the kind of book I know I should read, and I'll get to it. But Heinlein has never had for me that kind of fierce magnet. Interest. The Kornbluth biography by Mark Rich is quite good.
Yeah, yeah. I
and Kornbluth has that hold on me.
Rick Bowes, Nosemark Rich and all that. And I saw the book at his place, Rick's place. And I mean to get a copy. If I can, I'd love to interview Mark Rich. That looks like a fascinating book.
It's a terribly depressing book, as you can well imagine.
It would well be, yeah, come to think of it. Yeah.
And to characterize it fairly, I think, it is as much an anti-biography of Fred Pohl as it is a biography of Kornbluth.
Really?
Pohl does not come out of this looking well.
Mm.
Not well at all, and it's a...
I never knew Kornbluth, but I was a friend of Fred's when he was in New York.
Yeah.
And he was a, I wouldn't say frequent visitor to the show, but a regular visitor.
Yeah. Yeah. I heard him certainly a few times. He was on with Lester Del Rey, I think.
That's my very first show ever.
I think that Asimov, Del Rey, and Pohl, were.
That was my very first live radio show. Were those three people.
Isn't that remarkable? And as I said, I've mentioned this before, you had Alfred Bester in 1975 reading The Men Who Murdered Muhammad. Jesus Christ. I mean,
I'm looking for the air check.
That's like having James Joyce reading from you, the Ulysses. That's Beethoven giving a little preview. Here's some themes from the symphony on which I'm working.
Yeah, five notes.
My goodness. Alfred Bester reading The Men Who Murdered Muhammad at 5:50 a.m. on a Thursday morning? Wow.
Yeah. Would have been a Thursday at that point. That's right. Thursday or Friday, but I think it was a Thursday.
Yeah.
Heady times and... although I must say, sometimes people say, I didn't realize what I had when I had that, but no, I knew.
I can say that. Me too. I was driving at 5 a.m. in Bergen County, sleepless, and listening to Bester reading this.
Yeah, what I'm ashamed to say is that air check is one of many, many unlabeled cassettes. In many shopping bags.
And yeah, all this well.
Stuff has to be digitized.
Someday, but not in our lifetime or our descendants, but someday some wretched graduate student, Jim, will have a huge grant to do nothing but go through those shopping bags.
But you know what? It won't happen if it's someday in the far future.
Because it'll deteriorate.
That's right.
And turn to dust.
As it is when I broadcast my Bradbury interview a few weeks ago, and that was only 10 years old.
Yeah.
That had deteriorated. If it wasn't for the magic of Max Schmid, knowing how to bake, you actually have to bake, literally. You put the tape into the oven. And this is, I won't go into all the details, but that's part of a restorative process.
Mm-hmm.
He baked the tape, and we were therefore able to get it because tape that was made 10 years ago is nowhere near as good as tape that was made 50 years ago.
Right.
So the restoration process is a frightening one. And I not only have my tapes, I have Baird Searles' tapes, and I have a couple of tapes that belong to Tony Boucher, who worked for Pacifica Radio. He was music director at Pacifica. So
I heard one... Must be 35 years ago. There was a tape of Boucher from San Francisco, Berkeley. A program on castrati.
Yes, on strange voices.
Yes,
it was a half hour show. I have that.
Right.
It was on strange voices in general, and of course when he introduced the only known recording of the castrati, he said, and for those who are unaware, a castrato is a singer, is somebody who was cut out to be an opera singer. And then you know it's Anthony Boucher. If you knew anything about him, you knew that was who he was.
Yes.
Speaking of who people are, this is WBAI in New York City. Listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and webcasting at WBAI.org. And my name is Jim Freund. With me, Barry N. Malzberg, one of the luminaries of science fiction, working in the field since what year?
Going to read it today if we get to it. My first published story is in the August 67 galaxy.
Okay. And how long, will that reading be?
8 minutes.
Oh, only 8 minutes. Well, what we should do is we should get to it, I think. Right. I think we should take a cut of music.
Okay.
A little sorbet.
Okay.
And would you like to choose that for me?
Let us do cut two on here. This is the second movement of the Baba Yar Symphony No. 13 of Shostakovich. This is the second movement. It is entitled Humor, and I think it is a very good selection for 9/11.
Very good. So we will be back in
7 minutes and 35 seconds.
Indeed.
Manda pali parada mi, no yumarom, no yumarom, nimak. Творцы именитый газок, все дни возлежащих Михалину, являлся бродяга Эзоп, и не с теми они выглядели.
Являлся бродяга Эзоп, и не с теми они выглядели.
В домах Деханжа наследил своими ногами шуклими, всю пошлость Ханджана среди, зимая, как шахматы шутками.
Всю пошлость Ханджана среди, зимая, как шахматы шутками.
Морожи дудочки свой начинали сказ. Он звонко кричал, я дудочки, и не опускайся вперед.
путь им пальтишке, понурился и словно каясь. Преступником политическим он пойман и шел на фас. Всем видам покорность приказывал готов земному житю. Как вдруг из пальтишка выскальзывал, рукой махал и до черта с два удалось, решетки и стены каменные, он проходил насквозь, откашливаясь простужен, как рядовой боец. Шагал он с костушкой, простушкой, с винтовкой на зимний дворец. Рядом сумрачным, но это ему не вредит, и сам на себя с юмором, юмор порой глядит. Он вечен, он ловок, и юрок, пройдет через все, через все.
Shostakovich's Symphony No. 13, Bobby Yar, Peter, Mikuláš, probably, there's an accent over the S, so I'm going to guess, Mikuláš was the bass, and the Slovak Philharmonic Chorus with the Czechoslovak Radio Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Ladislav Slovak. And that is a Maxos recording. That's a label I'm not really familiar with. Maxos, M-A-X-O-S. Yeah. Oh, N, yes. Ah, okay, Naxos, okay. An anagram for Saxon. There we go. And this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. And at WBAI.org, the program is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor. With us this morning, Barry N. Malzberg, and we've been having just a scintillating, wonderful discussion.
Well, we've liked it.
Well, we've liked it. I think others will like it as well. I think that I think people love hearing the arguments of what is and what isn't within the genres of science fiction. And of course, everybody is all right and everybody is all wrong and all of that good stuff. But it, when you do it well, it's a wonderful discussion about
writing and about SF.
Yes.
Yeah. And, oh, by the way, let me mention to people that if you are a lover of literature after this program, you must stay tuned, as always, for Simon Lokely on As I Please, Part 2 of Red Wind by Raymond Chandler. And if you missed Part 1, you can go to archive.wbai.org and still hear that for another week. And then Part 2 will be this morning, and it will conclude next week. So, Barry, you were talking about reading your first published story.
I thought I'd read my first published story, add it to the BAI archives. Read a lot over the years, the 15 or so times I've been on this program. Read Gehenna twice.
Yeah.
Read a Tiptree essay once. Mm-hmm. So I thought I'd read my very first published science fiction story. It's my third story overall. I sold two stories on November 19th, 1965, and again on November 19th, 1966, I sold two stories to the men's magazine Wildcat, Kandor Publications, and was very pleased with myself. The stories were wretched, just wretched. But as I wrote my mentor, George P. Eliot, at the time I sold Galaxy, at last I've sold a magazine of which someone has heard. And this, I believe, is where my career started. It starts with this third story. This was the sale that made all the difference to me. It made all the difference because a poor thing that it was, 1,200 words, $36, I was able to establish to my own satisfaction, I could do this. I really could do this. I could write this and I could sell it. And a little glint appeared in my 27-year-old eyes, feeble and shrouded as they were. Gee, there's money in this, $36. And I called my old man from the drugstore from which I had called my agent, and I went on a job interview that morning, which of course I didn't get the job. I called my agent. He told me I had the sale. I called my old man. I said, I sold the story. Well, how much? I said, 1,200 words, $36. He said, well, next time you ought to do 12,000 words. And I thought that was good advice, in fact. And I did. My next sale was indeed a 12,000-word story. Be that as it may, this tiny story made all the difference for me. And I will put it, I will read it on there for the archives. It appears in the August 67 issue of Galaxy. I sold it on January 11th of that year to Fred Pohl. It's 1,200 words, will take eight and a half minutes to read. We're coming through the window. Dear Mr. Pohl, unfortunately, I, William Coyne, cannot send you a manuscript for consideration due to reasons very much beyond my control, which you will soon understand. All that I can do in the very limited time and with the limited opportunities available is to write things down as best I can in the form of this letter, and hope that you will be patient and understanding enough to see the great story possibilities in my problem. Perhaps after you see how important and unusual the situation is here, you will consent to write a story out of it yourself and keep 50% of the proceeds, which seems fair enough because you don't have to think up any idea. Or if you find yourself too busy to write it, you might turn it over to one of your regular authors, in which case he can do it and I will allow him only 40% of the sale price. But since this is a million-dollar idea, as you will see, there should be plenty of money in it for everyone if you will only work fast. Last week, I, William Coyne, invented a time machine. That is correct. I created from my own notes the first time machine. I, William Coyne, 29 years old, unemployed, and presently living in very cramped quarters. I built it by myself in these three furnished rooms on the west side of Manhattan, running back and forth between the hall sink and my bedroom, because, like my own body, the mechanism is 85% undistilled water. The machine worked out very well, considering that I know next to nothing about electronics, and the only science courses I have ever taken were for my high school equivalency diploma. I am not very advanced, as they say. Instead, I just kind of fiddle around, and I guess I fiddled myself into the machine. It is a very simple device, Mr. Pohl, and a very successful one. The only trouble is that its range is extremely limited. At the present time, it will take me back only 4 months into time, or forward 17 minutes. It is poorly calibrated, and at no time can I leave the actual time field, which embraces only 5 square feet. It is an early model, and it will have to be refined then on part of the proceeds from the story you will write about me soon. In spite of the problems, though, it definitely works. Just last Tuesday, I sent myself back 3 months in time, found the newspaper of that date lying on my desk, and my own humble form, the form of William Coyne, tossing fitfully upon the bed. It was an eerie experience meeting myself for the first time, and it shook me up considerable. But when I came back to the present time with the help of the machine, and before I could even look around, I was interrupted by the dashing appearance of my double, who motioned me urgently and requested in a whisper that 4 minutes hence I would please go backward 4 minutes in time, and then he, or me, vanished. It was very frightening, let me tell you, talking to myself, William Coyne, in my own rooms. But I counted off the 4 minutes and used the machine to go backwards, where I met my earlier self and told him, told me, that is, to go back 4 minutes in 4 minutes, like that. All right, Mr. Pohl, I know what you are thinking right now. You're saying that this is all old stuff for you and your writers, even though in my case, the case of William Coyne, it happens to be 100% true, and that you've seen it 1,000 ways. I read science fiction, too, or I used to before I got into this mess. But stay with me, Mr. Pohl. There are a couple of things I haven't explained to you yet, which will make clear why this situation is 100% socceroo for a good man like yourself. You can imagine how I got the plans for the time machine, of course. That's right, a few months ago I woke up in the morning to find all of them written out for me in my own handwriting on my dresser table. That was what I did when I went back the first time. I just used them, so I guess I didn't really invent them, or that all of us invented. But that is of little importance, Mr. Pohl, except to point out that I am not a creative genius, and that that is why I need help in my situation very, very fast. You see, the trouble is this. I told you that the machine didn't calibrate exactly, and every time I go back to the present, I don't go to the exact present, but instead a few seconds or minutes off in either direction. So now, every time I jump around, I always come back to meet myself, and if I jump back and try to come in exactly on time, I just make more difficulties. The same thing happens every time I go back in time. I'm always meeting myself on the way. Well, what it comes down to is this. I'm always meeting myself now, and the more I try to straighten things out, the worse it gets. As a matter of fact, Mr. Pohl, I'm afraid to make any more jumps, because the more I've tried to straighten out this situation, the worse it's become. Well, the truth is that there are now about 300 of us in these rooms, Mr. Pohl, all of us fooling around with tiny time machines, and none of us getting along very well. I mean, I've stopped trying to straighten myself, but most of the others haven't yet. They have to learn the hard way, and in the meantime, there are just more and more of us. Right now, in fact, there are about 310, for instance, just in the few short minutes I've been able to borrow the typewriter from the other 53 of us who all are trying to write letters for help. As a matter of fact, we're about to be evicted for overcrowding, Mr. Pohl, and in the bargain, there's no food or space left here anymore. And any time one of us goes out for food, he seems never to come back with it. Not that it would do us any good, because I had 2 cents in my pocket when this all began, and we would eat several thousand of us to get enough food to feed 10 of us, if you see what I mean. This is my situation, therefore, the situation of William Coyne. What can we do? We need to make big money from the machine real fast, that's the point, but we can't get out of the field, so how are we going to make it? And then we just keep on meeting up with ourselves and having to explain things all over again, and we're all dead broke. Please, please, would you have one of your writers, if not yourself, write a story about me, about us, and send the money just as soon as you can. We're all kind of desperate here. Hopefully, William Coyne, William Coyne, William Coyne, William Coyne, William Coyne, etc.
That's lovely.
Not bad.
I like that.
That's not bad for an unemployed 27-year-old kid. Fat kid in a room on 102 West 75th Street with his wife at work and his innocent 7-month-old daughter looking at him hopelessly from her walker. And that was the scene, Mr. Pohl, as I wrote about the big money time machine. But I have a real affection for that story because, unlike my second story, Final War, which was 12,000 words and had been written years earlier, this was a true science fiction story.
Yeah.
Whatever else, it has time machines and multiple personalities and time travel, and I felt that it demonstrated to my satisfaction that I could probably do this stuff.
Was that written as Barry Malzberg or as K.M. O'Donnell?
It was written as Barry Malzberg, but then labeled K.M. O'Donnell. Because, I blush to say it, fortunately the radio is not visual, but like the late and much beloved and deeply mourned Phil Klass, I wanted to save my real name for the real serious, important literature I would someday write. So I put on K.M. O'Donnell. I outgrew that attitude in about 30 seconds after I had made this sale and realized how happy and gratified I was. But then when I sold Final War, the 12,000-word story to FNSF, which did make my reputation, I kept the K.M. O'Donnell because I didn't want K.M. O'Donnell to be one of those pseudonyms, one of those names which just drifted in and out of the magazines and was never heard of again. I wanted to give it some presence. There's an on the table of contents in this August 67 Galaxy is someone named or writing under the name of Linda Marlowe, who was never published again. And I didn't want it to be a Linda Marlowe, so my first 8 or 9 stories and my first 3 or 4 novels were by K.M. O'Donnell, by which time I was grateful and eager to crawl out and have everything under my own name.
Yeah.
So that was it. I like the story. As I said, I have an affection for it disproportionate to its length and venue.
I like it a lot. And reminds me, there is one Stanislav Lem story which it echoes in a way in which there are, is it one of the Perks, the pilot stories? It's a favorite story of mine in which there are, it's really a parody.
Pricks the pilot?
Perks, I think. P-I-R-X.
Perks, P-Y-R-X or P-R-Y-X.
There are so many of him. He's going through a point of space. And where, for whatever reason, he's running into himself to the point where they're forming committees and trying to determine what to do, and one future version beating up an older version, and the older version knowing that this is going to come and trying to war. Wonderful. It's a longer story.
Yeah.
And it doesn't quite hold up all the way through. But it's got some hilarious moments in it. And, of course, taken as a whole, it's all about what was going on, I guess, in Poland, in communist Poland at the time that he wrote it.
Yes. Yes. And of course, we talked earlier about referencing SF. It's Heinlein's By His Bootstraps, which lurks underneath. This is a variation.
Yeah.
Almost a parody.
And for that matter, All You Zombies, because Heinlein took the same premise twice.
Exactly.
Easily twice.
18 years apart.
Yeah.
And then David Gerald took it in The Man Who Folded Himself.
Which I call The Man Who Fondled Himself.
Yeah. Yeah,
which is a good description of what happens. And
yes,
in that work.
Yes, well put.
And you only need one letter to change it. I entered that in some FNSF competition. They have competitions all the time in the back pages of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction.
Yes, yes.
Where, you know, favorite ace doubles,
yes,
for example. And I was very disappointed I didn't win. One of my favorite never-existed ace double, where you had two short novels in one volume, was... No Blade of Grass by John Christopher, along with The Sheep Look Up by John Brunner.
Yes.
So I always like those. I think Gordon is still doing them.
Very occasionally, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't recall my entry. I won honorable mention, I know, for something in one of the contests a long time ago.
If you would like to call up and speak with Barry N. Malzberg about his work, about the nature of science fiction and fantasy through the years and all that, something we haven't discussed at all, you know, the Rediscovery Award, which is...
The Cordwainer-Smith.
Yeah, the Cordwainer-Smith Rediscovery Award, which is just such a wonderful thing to have in existence at all. It's great. It's my favorite moment at ReaderCon, actually, is every year the presentation of that. And you made waves this year. In describing it as basically, you know,
I said that this is basically an award for failure. It is defined as an in the tradition of the great Cordwainer Smith, pseudonym of Paul Leinbarger, 1913 to 1966. This is an award for a writer not well known or read at the present time, whose work deserves rediscovery. And I added this, and what we are talking about then essentially is an award for failure. And I said the problems of this award are manifest as a committee member begins to investigate it. What do you say? Do you say, well, Mr. Miller, you are a candidate for the Rediscovery Award, but you're not unknown enough. You keep on being unknown. Sink deeper. Fail better, as Beckett says. You can always, what is it like then to be a runner up? For your work is not quite good enough, or you're not completely forgotten enough, but maybe next year. There's an anomaly or an oxymoron built into this. Be that as it may, it has been given.
And then the biggest buzz in the room was after the presentation this year had been given, was saying...
I said the winner this year is... And you know, I'm blocking on it, which is exactly right.
Was it A. Merritt?
No, A. Merritt was the year before. This was my man, Mark Clifton.
Right.
And I said the winner is Mark Clifton, 1906 to 1963. And I said, I now, and there was silence. And I said, I can see physically coming from this, a miasma of who dat? Who Mark Clifton?
Which is exactly
the point. And then I explained who Mark Clifton was. Mark Clifton was the hottest writer in Astounding for a 3-year period between 54 and 56.
I remember, you know, when you were announcing it, I vaguely...
He dominated Astounding as no writer of that period.
Interestingly, I've known a number of the writers who have been granted the award. Daniel F., I think we always said Galloy.
Galloy, R.A. Lafferty, A. Merritt, Stanley Weinbaum. Yeah.
Lafferty to me is just one of the greats, one of the greats of all time. And any time he is forgotten, somebody should do something about that.
Yes, yes, I certainly agree with that.
So the telephone number here at WBAI, I don't know that I mentioned it before, is area code 212-209-2900 to speak with Barry Malzberg. And the rule is be on topic. And good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, James.
Good morning, Robert.
To you and Mr. Malzberg, Shana Tova to both of you.
Thank you very much. The same.
I loved your little story, and yes, it is a Perks, because I think, Jim, you read it once on the air.
More than once.
At least once.
I just don't remember the name of it, unfortunately.
No, and I wish I did, but it was a Lem story.
It was the tale of Perks, the pilot.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mr. Malzberg, I love your word fabulation.
Well.
I wish that when I had taught my high school course to interested students in world literature or folk literature, although the second part of it was actually speculative and fantastic fiction with oral roots, I wish I had had that word in the title. I love that word. Let me ask you then, by your definition, if we throw in the merrillization, what a lovely word, would you include under that umbrella the likes of, say, Margaret Atwood's Bluebeard's Egg, which is a wonderful story?
Well, I would cut you off by saying that under that definition, everything could be included.
Oh.
That was Merrill's obsession.
Okay.
Oh, fiction.
You
yeah.
just filled that tent. You kicked everything under the tent, from the Bible to Homer to King Lear. Certainly, The Tempest was purest science fiction.
Oh, absolutely,
no?
The Tempest.
Of course. Oh, well, then by that definition, any of Shakespeare's plays would be considered.
Certainly, the Henry plays, the Chronicles are all alternate history, you know.
Well, that's yes, that's.
I think we'd call them spin, but
yes,
yeah.
I mean, that's another. Don't even get me on that subject about alternate. I mean, I love alternate history when it is well done, but there's much in history books to me that's alternate history. I never believed a history textbook. In fact, there's an old Polish legend about two books that are arguing whether they should be at the front of the library. And an old philosopher coming down the road says, you know, you both ought to be burned, not burned, but banished to the heap, the trash heap, because you, he points at the history book, you lie about the past, and you, the astrology book, you lie about the future.
Exactly.
But has that, by the way, that story ever been published in any of your anthologies?
The story I read?
Yes.
Collections.
It has appeared in an anthology edited by Martin Greenberg, first stories of well-known writers. It's been collected it's in my first collection. It's somewhere. It's been around. It's scattered.
Now tell me about The Final War.
Final War was published in the April 68 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. I had written it as a mainstream story about an endless war in February of 65, just when Vietnam was beginning to break into the consciousness of the chattering classes here. And I wrote it as a mainstream story about three military personnel engaged in an endless war. It was bounced by the standard literary markets, the Atlantic, the Hudson Review found it too grimly realistic. I put it away. It was called Shoe a Troop of Horse, and it referenced a quote from King Lear. I couldn't sell it. I put it away for several years. My sister had shown it to her English professor at Brooklyn College, who said it read like the first chapter of an interesting novel, but was not of itself successful. I had one of the few original thoughts of a lifetime in early 67. I retitled this Shoe a Troop of Horse. I retitled it Final War, and sent it to the science fiction market.
By the way, just one last comment.
That was Terry Carr who bought it, I think.
It was Ed Furman at the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction.
One last quick comment about YA and juveniles. I haven't heard that word juveniles, as you say, in a long time.
Yeah.
What's interesting is, for example, if you look at certain books and certain series, you see, for example, the Pullman series, the Golden Compass. Of those three books, only two are considered YA. If you look, for example, at the library listings for their shelves, the first two are YA, and the third is adult.
I think they're afraid.
Yeah, there are reasons for that, which I think
they all appeal to the same audience. But
yes,
but he is a vehement atheist, and it's not even his atheism that comes through. It is, by almost any definition, any pious person would consider that third book heretical.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
I mean, the bad guy is the creator in a war of angels. Come on.
Yeah.
Well, how would you define that?
No, you're right. But, you know, that certainly didn't.
It would make a preacher in Florida curdle. You know.
Oh, yeah. Well,
and well, it should.
Well, anyway, we'll talk another subject. Anyway, again, Happy New Year to both of you. And
thank you.
Keep up your good work, Mr. Malzberg. Let's hope that you will be with us again next September.
Well, Lord willing. Thank
so
you.
Long.
Thank you.
Have a good morning. 212-209-2900 is the number to call to speak to Barry Ann Malzberg. And good morning. You're on the air.
Yes.
I don't know what happened there. A technical problem. I'm terribly sorry. That was not intentional. But you can call back. But... And I had something, Barry, that I was going to ask you directly.
Mm.
And it has now escaped my scattered little brain.
Yeah, well, that happens too.
But getting back to Final War, that was a I know I have it in K.M. O'Donnell.
That was published as K.M. O'Donnell, yes.
Yeah. And so it seems to me that I had a whole bunch of K.M. O'Donnell books. You said two or three.
Well, the first...
I remember there's Gathering the Hall of Planets.
The first two collections were K.M. O'Donnell. Gathering the Hall of the Planets, Dwellers of the Deep were Ace Double short
right.
novels, which were K.M. O'Donnell. Universe Day, published by Avon, was K.M. O'Donnell. And The Empty People, Lancer Books. So that is
that is
six.
Yeah.
And then Terry Carr had taken The Falling Astronauts, under a different title. And I said I would like to publish it under my own name. And he said, well, there's no commercial value in your name. But he said, what the hell? I mean, Malzberg can write a good novel as easily as O'Donnell. So, and got me out from under.
And
Phil Klass never got out from under.
No, he was always William Tenn. He was always William Tenn.
Mm-hmm.
And a great surprise to many people, I think.
Yeah,
when they saw the disparity between who Phil Klass was and the image of William Tenn, the cardigan sweaters.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it did not help poor Phil that Philip J. Klass was a nonfiction
allegedly nonfiction.
Yeah, yes, and an anti-flying saucer kind of guy, with whom.
Pro-flying saucer, wasn't he?
No, he was a debunker.
Oh, okay, then I don't have a problem.
Yeah, well, he
although he took that a little
he was
far,
apparently an unpleasant person and not very kind and he was confused in Baird Searle's book. There were three authors of his Avon book, The Reader's Guide to Science Fiction,
right.
And embarrassingly, in the first edition, Phil Klass and Philip J. Klass were conflated.
Were they real?
If you read in the first edition,
how could they have
it.
Done that?
They did it. That Phil Klass has William Tenn has two identities, and as Phil Klass writes about flying saucers. I don't recall that.
We should mention to people, of course, that when my first non-filling out, taking phone calls job at WBAI was I was interned to Baird Searles,
mm-hmm.
who was our drama and literature director.
Yes.
So
he, of course, in partnership owned the science fiction store on 8th Avenue in Manhattan. And
where I was the stock boy.
And he...
And Beth Meacham was the cashier.
Right. And the three of them, Beth Meacham, his partner, Martin Last, and Baird, wrote The Reader's Guide to Science Fiction,
right.
which Avon published in 1975, and conflated the classes. And Phil Klass, the science fiction Phil Klass was infuriated.
Oh, he should be. And that's a shame. I didn't remember that at all.
Yeah.
212-209. We have 4 minutes. 212-209-2900 to speak to Barry Malzberg. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hi there. You're on the air.
Oh, yes. I have a couple of questions.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know what happened there.
I think we lost it.
Are you still there?
Nope.
Oh, hello. I want to speak to the author.
You're on the air.
Oh.
WBAI, New York.
99.5 FM.
Writers do that a lot.
Yeah, actually.
And often publish the results.
It's a sticky situation. Good morning, you're on the radio.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, James in Morrisburg.
Okay, Monroe, make it swift.
I'm on topic.
Getting low on time.
I'm on topic, James.
Okay.
I only have a couple of minutes.
You have less than that, Monroe.
When I read 1984, it was science fiction.
Yes.
But today, it is no longer science fiction because our society has changed.
It wasn't science fiction in 1984, Monroe. And it was not science fiction in 1949 when it was published. Orwell was not writing science fiction. He did not intend. Monroe, I just don't want... You can finish, Monroe, but I don't want to witness the finishing, okay?
Yeah, well, I'm afraid, Monroe, we will move on. Good morning. You are on the radio. Hello.
Yeah, I'm calling back. I have a couple of questions. One is, I really enjoyed what you were talking about in terms of science fiction and the different categories and how it melded or didn't meld with regular literary fiction. And I'm wondering if there is an equivalent in regular literary fiction that, as I noticed from your discussion of other shows, that you have such a deep understanding of your literature. If there's a comparable something like that in literary fiction, and two, can you both of you comment on swords and sorcery or Dungeons and Dragons type fantasy? Does that fit into your
comment? In what way? What kind of comment?
You view that as something within science fiction, and or
it is as no less than Kelly Link is. It is an extrusion.
It is
of science. I certainly see where sword and sorcery comes from science fiction. I'm not
without
happy.
Question.
I'm not happy with that, but I don't deny it's that connection.
It is without question within the same
absolutely
genre. What Robert E. Howard was writing
absolutely
is as Barry said, fabulous literature. It is absolutely the same genre.
Yes.
But no. It is not as popular as science fiction, or
much more popular.
It's more, yeah. It sells better. Fantasy sells first. Most fantasy sells better than science fiction.
Science
and
fiction.
And sorcery.
In my lifetime, I have seen. In my professional working lifetime, I have seen the reversal. Fantasy, when I came in 1965, was a small offshoot of science fiction. It is now exactly reversed. Science fiction, in terms of publishing categories, science fiction is a kind of disheveled, downrent suburb of fantasy.
But if you go to a bookstore and take a real physical place, and if you go to their science fiction section, you will see Conan the Barbarian
right
in the same shelves, you know, under H for Robert E. Howard, right by Heinlein.
And The Crystal World by J.G. Ballard and Camp Concentration by Tom.
Yeah, I was trying to find H's, but yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's Swords and Sorcery or Dungeons and Dragons?
Well, Dungeons and Dragons is a game.
It's a game.
There's no fiction category?
No. There are Dungeons and Dragons books.
Novelizations,
as novelizations.
It were, based upon the game,
oh,
yes.
Oh.
But it's a game.
So Swords and Sorcery would be...
Is the literary.
Sword and Sorcery category is the subgenre.
And do you recommend any titles in that area? Do you read in that area?
Not since I was 12 years old.
I would recommend some of the L. Sprague de Camp books. Robert E. Howard, of course. Mm-hmm. Fritz Leiber, L-E-I-B-E-R, a man who wrote great science fiction and great
yes
sword and sorcery.
Way yes back.
The Fawford and the Grey Mouser stories are wonderful.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Alternative history stuff or alternative worlds.
That's another.
That's
entirely,
yet another subgenre
entirely
and closer to science fiction than fantasy.
Holy smoke. So yeah, I'm glad you guys got it down because I'm learning a lot from listening to you, but it seems to spread out in all kinds of different directions.
Yes, it does.
It really does.
Yes, it does.
I think I'm without intending to, I may have hit on something when I said there is a diaspora.
Absolutely.
And that may be a very, very good
and that
term.
And that in conclusion, as it were, to kind of center this, I quote Charlie, the late Charles Brown, which is that science fiction has spread so far has been so successfully penetrated the culture that we don't need science fiction anymore.
Wow.
The problem, Charles Brown said to me in 2001, is we won the war. And that there is no place, there is nothing more embarrassing than the returned troops from a successful combat. What does society do with them? Where is there? What is the place? And that is what has happened. Science fiction has utterly overtaken the world. No question about it.
Well, you know, you're going to have to read a latter story now that you read your first. You should. I'm looking forward to you reading the story.
But next year.
Okay. Absolutely.
Okay, thanks so much for calling. Take care. Bye-bye. Well, we are well past out of time. But Barry, it is always a pleasure.
It's a pleasure, certainly.
And we will have you back, I assume, the second...
Mortality permitting,
The first Saturday after Labor Day.
Correct.
Next year. And maybe we should add one in there because we missed last year. We owe one.
Okay.
So we'll work that out. Everybody stay tuned for As I Please, featuring part two of Red Wind by Raymond Chandler.
Next week, American writer, Mr. Chandler. I want to say that on air. There is no praise sufficient for Chandler, who stands with Hemingway and Faulkner as our greatest writer.
Okay, so stay tuned. Next week on this program, Altered Fluid. Take care. Have a great week.
You are tuned to WBAI in New York City. That's 99.5 on your FM dial. And good morning and hello and welcome to As I Please for this, the 11th day of September in the year 10. There's something about that date which sounds familiar. And we will return to part two of Red Wind in about 25 minutes or so. So alert your friends and fans. Raymond Chandler will soon be on or in the air. However, I begin this morning with a note of a passing, an obituary notice that I read just the other day in the New York Times, announcing the demise of David Dortort, who was 93 years old and will be remembered forever as the man who created Bonanza. Now, some years back, I made a point of catching up on Bonanza, which was an enormously popular program for an enormously long stretch of time. 15, 20, I don't even know how long it was on the air, but I missed it when I was growing up, probably spending too much time reading bloody books. However, I did make this effort to catch up on this essential part of U.S. popular culture. Now, of course, when I say essential, that is, of course, up for grabs or open to interpretation. But it was a presence, at least. And I've got to say that in the long run, it was a long run. And when you have produced hours and hours of television drama, well, you can well understand that they're not all going to be of the same high quality, if indeed one can find high quality in television. However, disregarding my own quibbles and doubts about Bonanza, I will give credit to David Dordort, who really settled down to create Bonanza to counter the myth of the lone gunman. That whole notion of the American West, which remains still standard, I suppose, but David Dordort was able to say, but that's not what really happened. The growth of the West, the establishing of the West, is a story of families. And so he went about setting it. Now, of course, I don't think by any stretch of imagination the Cartwrights represented a typical, standard, or normal family, as Ben Cartwright was apparently a serial bridegroom, and all of his wives died suddenly. But he had three sons, who were remarkably the same age, or so it seemed, and each episode, you know, well, as the show went on, they would begin to alternate or vary who gets the focus. One day be a Ben story, then it would be a Hall story, then an Adam story, then a little Joe story, and every once in a while, the whole family would get together. Until the man who played Adam, Purnell Roberts, left. And Purnell Roberts died recently, too. And at that time, when he left Bonanza, he left not with pleasant feelings, a feeling that the demands of television performance were really killing his talent. And prior to Bonanza, Purnell Roberts had been greatly praised for a production of Macbeth. He played Macbeth in some New York Shakespeare Festival. I believe it was New York Shakespeare Festival. Got high praise as an up-and-coming actor. And indeed, even in the junk that sometimes Bonanza was, there was always a little glint in his eyes that said, well, he's got something on his mind that's a little bit more than just coming around for the next paycheck. But the danger of television is, of course, that ongoing stretching it out. We're not so much interested in stories as filling time. And you wonder, you know, what might have been if instead of week after week the same characters, there was some notion of a developing tale, a sense that these characters are more than characters, but representatives of the human species out in Nevada, I believe they were. And here we see that despite the good intentions of David Dordort, Hollywood, we'll use that term, Hollywood has its own concerns. And so whatever may have been the notion that we're going to try to counter the dangerous myth of the lone gunman, which fuels so much trouble these days, is replaced instead by a less dangerous myth, perhaps, but also less focused. And that is the sprawling, endless saga of a family that was really not going anywhere. I think it was Hugh Laurie who said, of course, in television drama, change is not the thing. You know, you really want to have the same thing happen week after week. And this is why I am, in fact, keen on what we might call genre programs on television, because at least they get the story over and done with in an hour. That's why I mentioned last week how much I like mysteries. Well, because even though they will try to cram in all this sort of background information about the love lives of the characters and so on, there's still a mystery that you can pay attention to that will be resolved at the end of the hour, and you can forget it and move on, as opposed to the stretching out of narrative. Well, Lost lost me when it became clear that they had no idea where they were going either. I'm presenting a case for the idea of telling a story on television, rather than finding some setup that you can repeat and rerun forever and ever and ever. A story of the Cartwrights and the Ben and his three sons spread over a course of 6 weeks with a beginning and middle and end would probably do more to shape our better understanding of the American West than the repetitious hour after hour after hour. And it is, of course, notable that the United States and its television production is not particularly keen on anything that might be considered historical, or what we might even call costume drama. We were laughing together just a few years ago about Mad Men. This is what passes for costume drama in American television today. That's that they're wearing narrow ties. Yes, this is cast your mind back. I've not been able to watch much of Mad Men. And I'll tell you why. It's because I know that it's another typical television drama, which means that I'll get suckered into caring about people that I'm not really interested in to begin with. I am interested in advertising and might actually be interested in Mad Men if it were three parts and over and done with. But the notion that I have to tune in next week, I'm just not going to do it. But if there is a potential for drama on television, then we should try. Well, of course, there's potential for drama on radio. We don't see that happening. Indeed, I've often felt that the idea of a historical drama, and indeed, even soap opera-ish, as far as that goes, would be wonderful on radio, where, one, you don't have to spend the money on the costumes, and, two, hearing these tales of the past, we might learn that the past isn't all that different from our present or our future. But it is true, no matter what one says and who doesn't, Bonanza is no Lear. And you know, they were always very happy about their prospects. There was never any squabbling amongst the Cartwrights. There was certainly no notion that one of them or another of them was going to be written out of the will. No, the Cartwrights were about as happy a family as one could imagine. And why? Because of Hop Sing. That's why. Oh, come on, I'm just joking, for crying out loud. But in seriousness and in appreciation, I note the passing of David Dortort. It was not completely successful, but it had a good idea. You know, as Ken Gale would say, better than nothing? Perhaps not. But it was something. You know, have you ever seen a program called Dr. Med Quinison Woman? It's a terrible program. Yeah, stupid program. And exactly the sort of thing I point to when I say this is the danger of so-called hysterical drama. Hysterical, I said that, and I meant it too. That notion that they will contemporize it with, in this case, 20th century issues set back in, I think, 1875 out in Colorado. That was Dr. Med Quinison Woman. Well, I'll tell you something. I watched one episode in its entirety, and the word crap springs to mind, but I will instead say profoundly insulting. This was an episode where, of all people, Walt Whitman visits Colorado and visits this town. And I can't even begin to tell you how wrong they got it. Now, in Star Trek, when they all go back to San Francisco in 1906 and talk to Mark Twain, I say, well, it's Star Trek, you know, and they're not trying to do anything historical. It's just a yarn, for crying out loud. But Dr. Med Quinison woman was very proud of the fact that we're hitting the issues of today, setting it in the past. Well, they really got Walt Whitman wrong. And on behalf of Walt Whitman, I vowed to boycott that program forever and ever and ever. And as an indication of the seriousness with which I treat this issue, I have not once since returned to Dr. Med Quinison Woman. A terrible program. A real insult to your IQ, if you have an IQ. Bonanza is also pretty goofy in the long run. But I did watch an episode this week that featured Pernell Roberts. And the other guys were out. They were supposedly in St. Louis or something like that. What were they doing in St. Louis, you would like to know? Well, they didn't say. But it was just Adam and a lone gunman. And I said, well, there you go. You know, Pernell Roberts was a good actor. Generally, I get a little nervous when somebody comes up to me and says, oh, this guy's a really good actor. One should hope so. But Pernell Roberts may have had a little bit more than being just a good actor. He might have really become something. He would have made a great Philip Marlowe, by gum. In any case, this episode was, well, it was self-contained. It raised interesting issues about truth, honesty, and all that sort of stuff. And it was over in an hour, which, of course, is high reason to compliment it to begin with. And so I watched it and I said, you know, obviously, you've got to produce week after week after week. So some flubs are bound to show up, and sometimes you just can't help it. You know, this one just wasn't quite as good as one had hoped. But that particular episode, for what it was worth, and remember, it's still just a cowboy story after all. But I'm watching it, and I said, yeah, there is a potential for television drama if